Hello to you, my sweet, bubbling goo of sentience. It's me, Trussell, and you're listening to the Doug and Trussell Family Hour podcast. I'm recording this from Spokane. Just did a bunch of shows at the Spokane Comedy Club. Two more tonight. Looks like they're going to sell out. Thank you, Jesus. How are you? I hope you're great. I hope you have somebody combing your hair, like a professional hair comber that follows you around, combs your hair, rubs your back, rubs your feet, whispers sweet things in your ear, rubs oil into your belly at night so you can relax, and most importantly, has an ample supply of benzos that puts you into the most incredible dreamless sleep you've ever experienced. If you don't have that, then I hope one day you will achieve it, as I have. You can find these hair combers at haircomber.gov. I'm not sponsored by them, but I would highly recommend it. It's a new government program. It's amazing. The federal government, I've always felt a little not great about the federal government. Freaks me out. Makes me worried. Some of those people seem like they might be robots, but I've kind of changed my thinking now that they've unveiled this new plan to get everybody these pleasuring hair combers. And it's amazing. It's a wonderful service. They decided to use 1% of the military budget that we're currently using, and that is more than enough to pay for a personal pleasuring hair comber for every single American. So I really do hope you'll check it out. When mine showed up, I was a little nervous to meet her, but she's a wonderful lady, beautiful, trained in all kinds of interesting massage techniques, including tantric massages, which if you haven't had one of these before, you need it. It's amazing. Her ability to comb my hair, stimulate my prostate, and get rid of a lot of dark energy related to my phallus is top notch. And I just want to thank you, President Biden, for this program, because I think it's really going to change my life. Again, it's haircombers.gov, and I hope you'll check them out. It's so worth it. You deserve a little bit of pleasure, and it looks like the federal government has finally realized that. What a podcast we have for you today. This is actually a very exciting episode of the DTFH. I have not mentioned to anyone that over the last few years, 5 years, one of my dear friends, Raghu Marcus, who introduced me to Ram Dass, who runs the Ram Dass retreats, has a huge part in the Ram Dass Foundation, and is just an all-around incredible person. For around 5 years, we've been recording an audiobook. We realized that we were having these deep conversations that centered around the idea of identity, the self, and this possibility that just maybe there's a way to be 5% less neurotic and selfish. And I think the reason we decided to start recording the conversations is because both of us recognize that we are experts at being selfish, neurotic, self-cherishing people. And so over the years, we've just been recording these conversations, and finally, we've put them together into an audiobook called From the Movie of Me to the Movie of We, a title that Krishna Dass graciously let us use. It's just us having an ongoing conversation, and it's a really, really cool thing that Raghu put together, because you can sort of follow our journey through time. We go through the pandemic. I mean, we've been doing this for years. I hope you will check it out. It is available on Audible, and all the links you need to find it will be at duncantrussell.com. Before we jump into the podcast, some quick announcements. I hope you will subscribe to our Patreon. It's patreon.com/DTFH. You'll get commercial-free episodes of this podcast. And I have some shows coming up that I would like to announce. I'm headed to Salt Lake City. That one, don't put off getting tickets, because one of the shows is already sold out, and it looks like all of them are going to sell out. So just get the tickets. I know it's annoying. Nobody wants to get tickets. I don't like getting tickets, but you can find the ticket links at duncantrussell.com. Salt Lake City, that's November 17th to the 18th. Then I'm going to be in Charlotte at the Comedy Zone, December 14th through the 16th. And then in January, you can catch me at the Comedy Works, January 11th through the 13th. And then January 25th, I'll be at Helium in Indianapolis. All the tickets, all my shows are now up at duncantrussell.com. All right, let's jump into this wonderful episode with my dear friend, Raghu Marcus. Raghu, welcome back to the DTFH. It is so great to see you. How is Ojai?
Ojai is great, but I'm happy to be back. I love just being able to hang out on a warm afternoon here in Ojai.
Yeah, I know, yeah. It's not a warm afternoon here in Spokane. It's rainy and bleak, which I love. After this Texas summer, some nice, drizzly, cold rain is heaven.
Yeah. Spokane. Great.
Yeah. Spokane, friend. Not Spokane. Spokane. Okay. Yes. It's
never
not,
been there.
Even though it's spelled Spokane.
Yeah.
It's Spokane. Yeah. Well, yeah, I'm in a haunted hotel, apparently. The Uber driver told my friend that this is a very haunted hotel. Has nothing to do with, I think, of what we're going to talk about today, but I have to ask, because I don't think I ever asked you this. All your travels to India and God knows where else, all your encounters with various holy people. Have you ever had a ghost experience?
Ghost is too black and white. Certainly some... being in a place where you kind of could feel entities of energy, you know, that had not been released or something, you know, maybe
right.
had died in the house or so on.
Right.
So, yeah, I've experienced that, but not Halloween ghosty kind of thing.
No. Yeah, I've experienced that too. I don't know how I feel about it. I've read some things saying that actually... you know, they studied this, like the claim people make to feeling that something is haunted or there's something dark there. And a lot of the times they find mold in the basement and they think that it's just a reaction to mold. But
that's more, you know, let's bust the idea that anything is possible and all is possible. But in this case, you know, energy fields, people who have died. Definitely, many people get confused about, wait a minute, I'm not alive anymore. There's still connectivity in the early stages of the earlier Bardo's liminal states. And I, you know, of course, they're a little bit confused, which is why many of the mystic traditions have, you know, a whole liturgy around this is what you need to remind the soul or the Buddha mind, whatever it may be, that is moving on. And it's okay. You can leave now. You can go off. Everything is fine. You've been forgiven for whatever BS that you happen to get into in your lifetime.
Right.
You know, like that. I mean, there's a whole litany of it. Of course, as you know, and I say all the time, I know, not in my head, that everything is possible. By the way, speaking to this a little bit.
Okay.
I did a podcast yesterday with Bruce Damer, our friend.
Oh, he's awesome. I haven't talked to him forever.
I know. I hadn't since the beginning of the pandemic. do you know? And so I say, you know, because he's involved with, he's advising the Japanese Space Agency on, you know, they're looking for the origin of life on Mars and stuff like that, right? Really out there.
Wow.
I mean, he's amazing. So he said that he was in with some other researchers in New Zealand in some ancient hot springs, and they were, you know, just spooning up stuff. I don't know what, plasma right. or whatever, from the hot springs. Anyhow, bottom line, they are on their way to proving that it's not about a single organism's our origin, a cell that divided its whatever, right?
Right.
It's about a group that interacts together of these organisms, which you need to do a podcast with them because you're smart. I couldn't catch.
I saw his talk on this.
Oh, you did?
Something like this. He had some kind of ancient rock, and he was talking about this sort of paradigm that we're taught, which is single-celled organism becomes multicellular over time, and how like that sort of paints this almost lonely, individualistic picture of evolution when it's a collaborative sort of harmonization more than like
exactly
the way that we've been taught.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it was fascinating. And he's got a paper coming out on it in one of these, amazing bio blah, blah journal. And it just struck me, and we talked about it, he and I. I mentioned Duncan and I just put out an audiobook. It just came out, the movie of me to the movie of we. And what you just described is exactly what the journey is to realize this interconnectivity is who we are and where we come from, not this separate I, the me. So, it was pretty amazing.
There was something that I... when I was in college, this very long time ago, one of the professors was talking about, and I don't know, some Native Americans, or maybe it's like an indigenous culture. Mm. But he was saying they didn't have a word for me. Like whenever they referred to themselves, it was we, because they didn't think of themselves as separate from the tribe. They were just one, I guess, appendage in this collective that they've been born into.
Right.
And so they didn't even know I. It didn't even make sense to them that anyone would refer to themselves as a me, which is so cool. So cool.
That's but this
is amazing. But this is the West, and this is the world we were born into. You're born into a world that doesn't just tell you you're a you, but encourages you to be a leader. Did you ever get any of that shit when you were in school? Like how good it is to be a leader?
No, I was so much in survival mode all the time.
Oh, yeah.
That if that came up, I don't recall it at all. I mean, well, I had horrendous early school experiences.
Oh my
God. You know from the book.
I know. So you must have brushed shoulders with, if not, and it might be you were in Canada, like it might just be a more of an American thing, but
right
here,
rah, yeah,
being a leader is considered the most important thing. You never want to be a follower. You want to be a leader. And this is the most insane, when you really think about it, it's the most insane thing to teach anybody, in the sense that leaders depend on followers. You're encouraging everyone to be a leader, and thus negating the what a leader has to have to function, which is followers. And so it's a very Western kind of teaching, because really what they want is for like some people to become bosses, and everybody else to become an employee.
I think it's more patriarchal, I think, because this is not happening just here. In the West, this is in the East, where, you know, you are an individual, you need to get out there and lead the posse.
Yes.
And that individualization is less in some respects, say in India, which I'm most familiar with, in the East, because they've got a culture that allows for the group consciousness to move forward in the way that they're so connected with spirituality, not necessarily always, shall I say, in the deepest truth. Sometimes, many is a time, and you know, we've met many people over there, many a time, they're just, they're going through the motions because of the culture dictating to them a certain role. And that role thing is what we're, what you're talking about. Become a leader. It's a role that you're going to, they say you must inhabit that role. And as you say, well, what about the other role? You can't have that role without the other role. So what are we talking about? You know, the follower. So I think it's universal.
Oh yeah, it is. I'm sure it is. It's, I mean, what we're talking about is I guess you could argue like a kind of idealistic way of looking at things. But it does seem that this is in human history, at least in my like very, very like low grade understanding of human history. This is a hyper individualistic time that people rarely even get a chance to experience that thing that happens when you merge with a group, which, you know, many people have experienced it with psychedelics, at Burning Man, at raves. It can happen where your identity just is gone all of a sudden and you've become part of this greater mind. And when that happens, it's the most incredible thing you've ever felt. It's like drinking water that you didn't even know you were thirsty. And then all of a sudden you're unencumbered from the I identity and you just, it's magical what happens. And many people say that there's like actual exercises you can do with groups of people, even though who's even going to do that? It would feel so weird doing that. But there's exercises you could do with groups of people, usually through some breathing techniques that induce that state. Yeah.
What about just chanting together or even meditating together?
Yeah, yes.
You know, it all creates exactly what you're talking about.
There's exercises you could do with groups of people, usually through some breathing techniques that induce that state. Yeah, of
what about just chanting together or even meditating together?
Yeah, yes.
You know, it all creates exactly what you're talking about. Yeah. I completely, though, going back to Bruce Damer and the idea that we do not come from a separate cell that splits or whatever, that we come from something that is completely interconnected material of some sort.
Yeah.
And you know what? Another podcast I did with David Silver, it was around the yugas. So I had all the Hindu set out of different time periods that different reflections of humanity get bespoke in a much more profound way. Supposedly we're in the Kali Yuga now. We all say that, hey, we're in the Kali Yuga. To me, it was like woo-hoo kind of stuff, right? That, you know, how's it going to really benefit my day-to-day life or anybody else's day-to-day life? Anyhow, so we had this book, and it's really phenomenal. And these two guys put this whole thing together, and it was way wiser than it wasn't a New Agey kind of thing. And one of the things they said in it, how each epoch reflects humanity is really the core thing about it is the interactivity of the people at that time and what they do and how they act, you know, what their ethics are, what their morals are, what their connection to mysticism is or not, and how they interact sets up what the reflection is in that particular era. It's right. not black and white. It
right.
was amazing. Another indicator of, yes, our interaction is what it's all about. And having people in power in the different parts of this world that is such a very troubled place yeah. right now.
Yeah.
Having these people who absolutely have no connectivity to anything beyond their me, their ego, their, you know, attachment to power and money or whatever it may be. That is, and so people are reacting off of that. Look at the schism in this country now, the polarity of the left and the right. And now the left is splitting, is yeah. doing another schism because of what's going on in the world.
Yeah.
And so this is a pretty, a little bit nervy reflection related to the epoch that we happen to be in.
Yeah. I mean, it got embodied. You know, this is something Carl Jung talks about, how the shadow of society gets reflected out into the world. And so it's like the pandemic was a projection of just what you're talking about, because what was one of the main rules during the pandemic? Social distancing. You know what I mean?
Stay away from everybody.
Stay away from each other. Separate.
You're
going to
die.
So it was like this thing that was already happening anyway, because of computers, because of the lack of, you don't need to go out to date anymore. You can do it on your phone. You could find someone on your phone, theoretically. It was like all of that division appeared in this disease that encouraged more of that division. Stay at home, stay separated. And so, yeah, I think you don't just have to go from the inside out in this Jungian way. You could theoretically go from the outside in, look at what's happening in the world, and then you'll know what's happening inside of everybody, which is
which is really scary.
Really, really scary. A lot of confusion, a lot of division or sort of taking sides.
Yeah.
Right and wrong. My side is completely right. Your side is completely wrong. Like all. So that means that inside people must feel divided in the same way. I think
absolutely.
So what is that feeling of, why do people feel divided inside? What is this sort of, I don't know, schisming or fragmentation happening inside of people? What are they feeling separated
from? The biggest thing is not feeling like they are part of a group of some sort or
right.
a mission or a purpose. They feel like they've been left behind. So that creates anxiety and fear. And anxiety and fear is what promotes this feeling, I have got to defend myself, and therefore I have to create an other.
Right.
That, you know, that's, by the way, you spoke to it in the, I keep mentioning the book.
We did it. We made an audio book together, you guys, that we've been working on for 5 years now or something like that, time. Yeah. I guess you could say it's sort of like very long podcast, but it's much more organized.
Right. Well, it comes from different, just hanging out and recording. It comes from podcasts. It comes from all sorts of different areas. You know, when you say 5 years on this book, by the way, it goes through all these different time periods, different things were happening. I mean, the most pronounced of course, we said one day, okay, we're in the pandemic, we better talk about it. We're going to put this book. So I love this piece that's, you know, I think we put it out as a little sample of the book on social, and it's you talking about how in the pandemic in Italy, the singer came out and he's entertain he or she is entertaining the people, and it's a wonderful experience and operatic, and it's just like so much
Oh,
passion.
wait, in New
And
York,
somebody in the
you mean New York?
and then what do? They took it and tell us about the New York thing.
Yeah.
Tell that story.
Well, I think maybe you guys have seen this, but someone was trying to help in New York, and in their mind, trying to help was, I think, in the morning, going out on their balcony and doing some kind of opera. And like they did it for a little bit before just out of some window, someone's like, "Shut the fuck up! Shut the fuck up!" It was so absolutely hilarious. And but because I think, by the way, this book, this audiobook, this is just we just decided to record this conversation we've been having maybe since we met, which is this exploration of of identity and you and me and the potential to not be so mired up in like selfishness, not like selfishness in the sense of like you eat the last piece of pie, but selfishness, like what did you do? It was called self-cherishing, where you become your singular fixation in the world. But yeah, that a lot of what's really sad is like because people do have this sense inside of them that there's this potential for connection via some form of service or openness, they then try to make that connection, but by glorifying themselves as they make the connection. You know what I mean? So that's what produces that cloying version of it, where even though the person appears to be doing something in service of others, it just reeks of narcissism and then makes people feel even more separated from them, thus doing maybe more harm. Maybe it would have been better for them to not do anything at all.
Just sit home and feel separate. No, but the reality is, of course, listen, there was an impulse to do this, you and I. I say it in the book at some point. I was just sick of the constant self-referential behavior and the constant just absolutely feeling all of these different emotions because I see the motivation. I mean, I've been doing a lot of work for many years, right, at my age, and mindfulness is a great thing. It really allows you to take a look at yourself. And when you see the selfishness and the grasping basically go on, go on, go on, then you start to think, okay, what do I do? Because I'm just so unhappy in this kind of a situation. I want to do something to save myself, and in the saving of myself, and that just means be more equanimous, being more content, happy on a day-to-day basis, not feeling so absolutely motivated by manipulative kind of behavior. And so it's like, okay, what can I do? In our case, we went, well, let's talk about it. Maybe it'll help somebody else.
Maybe it'll help us. Because I think one of the problems is that at first, and I think, I don't know about you, but I can speak as like a professional selfish person. Like I am so good at being selfish. And in like the beginning of it, you don't even realize you're being selfish. You think it's just completely normal to spend every day trying to gratify your senses or trying to achieve something just for you or trying to get to the next level just for you. This is what we've been taught. It feels normal. And you don't realize that the happiness, the thing you think you're feeling, it's not even happiness. It's more of like a kind of obsessive scratching at an itch or something, and it's not working anymore. And the highs you get from the success are not, they don't, hit quite as hard. And but you keep going and going and going for it, trying to refine the way you pleasure yourself or gratify your senses. And at some point, I think you get to where you were, what you were mentioning there, where you just realize, like, why don't I just, like, I might as well have like a 160-pound baby that I'm taking care of, because that's what it's like, giving the baby booze, giving the baby ketamine, getting the baby blowjobs. You know what I mean? Like, all the things you're doing are exhausting, and you realize that you've become a slave to yourself, which is a very strange feeling. And that is
supporting that
claustrophobic feeling.
Well, that's, I like the section in the, I like your whole premise in the book around pyromania. We, that penchant that we all have to have that inside ourselves.
You mean to,
that's,
yeah,
to become a pyromaniac. And it's not a pyro, and we're not physically lighting fires, but we are absolutely lighting fires everywhere we go.
A karmic pyromaniac
situation. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. But, you know, I think everybody knows when that motivation kicks in. I really do. I don't think, I think, just think of simple things like motivating somebody else, manipulating and motivating someone else to do something that will benefit you. It could be in the workplace. It could be in the love area, relationship area. We do that day to day because we are wanting to manipulate the world to get what's most desirable for us, you know?
Yeah.
It's, that whole thing, you know, that Ram Dass read that third patriarch, right?
Yes.
That beautiful, beautiful thing around preferences that we talk about also in the book. I mean, yeah, this is all about preferences.
Preference. Right.
This is all about that.
What is it? It's the great way is not difficult for they who hold no preference. And, you know, this is, you know, now that I have three kids and now that I'm in this.
You have a few preferences.
if you have managed to isolate, you don't realize how painful your preferences are. Like, you don't realize that they're hurting you. But when you're like surrounded by maniacs and whatever you think your day is going to be like when you have three kids, it's not, you don't know what it's going to be like. It might be better than you thought, or it might just suddenly spiral into ridiculous catastrophe out of the blue. And if you have, if you're attached to how you think the day should go, it's hell. I mean, I think this is why you hear like the version of parenting where people are like, this is hell, I don't know what I've done, versus this is paradise. Because the moment you let go of the preferences, it's hilarious. You're like, you're just in a boat floating down a river of madness in the funniest way. And it stops being so serious. And it stops, you stop getting offended if you don't get your way. Or a lot of people feel disrespected if they don't get their way. Like, the whole world is supposed to be making sure their preferences are met.
Yep.
But there's something really beautiful when you let go of that. And I think that's what we're talking about here. A lot of people feel disrespected if they don't get their way. Like, the whole world is supposed to be making sure their preferences are met.
Yep.
But there's something really beautiful when you let go of that. And I think that's what we're talking about here.
Yeah. Now, some people may say, what, are you crazy? Of course I prefer this, that, or the other. Of course I prefer not to have pain. Of course I prefer to have pleasure. I mean, basic items. Yes. That is true.
Yes.
And I guess, you know, and we are human and we are going to have preferences.
Yeah.
I guess, though, you do get to a point. on there's two levels of it. There's micro and macro. Micro being what's directly affecting you in the moment, and you're going to have a preference that either defends the moment or takes advantage of the moment. Then there's the macro. Look what's going on in this world. It's hard to turn away from that. My preference is I can't watch this
show. Right.
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 Right. On the other hand, I am a citizen of the world, of the nation and of the world. How can you turn your head away from it?
Right.
And then you start to think, okay, maybe I need to just get myself better situated, a perspective that can take in all of the pain and can take in all of the pleasure at the same time without reacting and grasping one way or
right.
the other. Now, that's a very, very difficult thing. It's a lifetime of work. And I guess most people may say, you know, what would be the motivation to even approach this situation of no preference? It sounds like something in the distance that cannot be achieved,
right, yeah.
you know. But yeah. in the moment-to-moment encountering of it, you really do, I believe, and I've seen it in myself over many, many years, you really do see something transforming slowly but surely.
Yeah.
And, it you know, it happens.
I think a good way to start with it is not to fit, because don't pretend you don't have preferences. That's hilarious. Anytime I try to do that, like, yeah. you do know what I mean? Where you like wake up and you're like, today I'm going to be like Neem Karoli Baba. I'm just going to love everyone I see, and I'm going to go downstairs and make the kids breakfast, and it's just going to be love. I'm not going to get frustrated. No preferences. I'm going to surrender to the moment. And then like the toddler screams in your face because you pulled his pajama sleeves over the fake Band-Aid that you put over a non-existent wound the night before. And he expects you to know, like, obviously never cover my imaginary Band-Aid. And he's screaming at you and you haven't had enough sleep and you haven't had coffee yet. Do you know what I mean? And then the reality sinks in. No, that you're not getting over this preference that you don't want to be screamed at by your child
yeah, right.
for pulling his sleeve right. down. So it hurts. It's pain. And so I really love the method taught in that book you told me about, why we meditate. Handshake practice. You know, do you remember that part
yeah.
of the book?
I think so, yeah.
It's real good. And the idea is that, so instead of lying to yourself and saying, I have no preference, the handshake practice would be when that feeling of wanting things to go another way pops up, shake hands with it and say to it, you're real. In other words, I am having this experience, but not true. The story you're telling is not true. Because preference is just, I think, a reaction to suffering, right? It's a,
yeah.
it hurts, you're in pain, you're suffering. And so you think, oh, I will end this suffering by whatever, getting pancakes or going into another room where it's quiet or like leaving to go to Las Vegas for the rest of my life or whatever your stupid idea is, you know? But that, so it tells a story. The particular feeling tone has a story attached to it. And usually that story has a lie in it, which is like, you know, if you just had like a mimosa, you would feel better or something, right? So I love the handshake yeah. practice. I love acknowledging, yeah, the preference is here. But then not following through with what it's telling you to do necessarily. Yeah.
And again, this is all mindfulness stuff, you know, and very much through all of our conversations and practice, that has been so important. It is so important. It's not like you're going to get cured.
No.
It's not like you're going to walk into a situation where your toddler's screaming at you and you're going to be able to just be completely equanimous.
No.
It's not. but it's going to present something that is going to allow that transformation to take place at some time or place that we don't know about.
Right.
Hey, this book, you know, it's amazing that you meditate. Why we meditate, which is with my friend Danny Goleman and his teacher and others of us that were friends back in the day, Tsokni Rinpoche, who is a son of Tulku Urgyen Rinpoche. I know this is a little exotic,
yeah,
but this guy was the greatest meditation teacher from Tibet in the last 200 years. And he had four sons, and they all became teachers as well. And Tsokni is a phenomenal teacher. Anyhow, I just happened to be looking through this book before we were getting on. And I thought, wow, I've never even mentioned this to you. This would have been great in the Movie of Me book. So a key practice in his tradition is understanding reification. Have you ever heard that?
No.
Do you know what reification is?
No, I've heard it. I want to lie and be like, of course I know what reification is, Raghu.
Yeah.
Remind me what reification is. I'm sure I'll remember the moment you say what it is.
It's the tendency to make things more concrete or realer than they naturally are.
Okay.
It's solidifying stuff. Okay.
That's cool.
What do we reify? Everything. When our mind reifies, all we experience gets seen through that lens. This is what we are talking about,
right,
in terms of the complete, abject, unconscious, ignorant behavior that we carry on day to day.
Right.
We call it projecting, maybe. You know, that may be one of the words.
Reification and projection are kind of the same thing.
Well, I think reification actually has much more of a profound meaning. Projecting is like, okay, we have a thought and we're projecting. You see somebody on the street, you project what it is that, you know, you're getting from them. You know, if it's sexual, if it's, I got to avoid that person because it's a homeless person, whatever it may be. So there's a projection. I think reification, he says it's like believing a dream is real, right?
Right.
Then if we believe our dreams are real, then we can get very excited by sweet dreams and very scared and upset by bad dreams.
Right.
We do the same during the day with our memories, thoughts, and fantasies. We automatically reify our perceptions as we experience an quote-unquote I, that's the old I, who is subject, and what's in the world around us or in us, as with our thoughts, as object. The habit of reification has become the tendency to fixate deep in our beings.
Okay, that's so cool. That is so cool.
You know, then this sets us up for increased anxiety, fear, stubbornness, heaviness, inflexibility, uncontrollable moods, neurotic thinking, and so on.
Yeah.
So it is something to attend to because we have all of those things. We have this, and especially today, we have such tremendous anxiety and we're fixed about stuff. And then that makes it even much more difficult to transform in our day-to-day lives. And I think that is so immensely important.
It's like everybody's like an ice cube tray. With different shapes. You know, you get the fancy, stupid ice cube tray, it'll make your ice look like beautiful little, like, balls, like for your special drinks, or a silly ice cube tray, make it look like a Christmas tree or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? But we're like that. Like, we're taking just phenomena, which is essentially empty, sucking it into the ice cube tray of our karma and identity, and then freezing it into this shape that we call reality, even though we know, like, our version of reality is purely subjective versus another person's and another person's, not just like emotionally or the stories we tell ourselves, but literally spatially. You know, you're over there, I'm over here. Your version of reality that you're seeing is very different from mine. And there's something incredibly exciting thinking about how, I don't always have to freeze reality into the worst version of reality. It doesn't always have to be a paranoid hellscape or a dying world or a world where I'm a failure or a world where I've been hurt and wronged and can't forgive or a world where I know that person meant to hurt me. That, you know, that's just that what you're forming reality into that. That's reification. And it's, and it's instantaneous. That's what's so, to me, what's really beautiful about it is how quickly we can do it. It's effortless. Like, you don't have to spend any amount of time congealing reality into a paranoid hellscape.
You know? I'd hate to call it that beautiful, but okay. You know, I mean, it's amazing. You're right. You're absolutely right. The ease of at which we produce this stuff is extraordinary, you know?
Yeah.
But, you know, the corollary is the ease at which we can do this reification, basically, is the same as the ease at which, if we just switched, just to pull a switch, that we can not grasp at
right.
it. You know, we can you can realize it. It's so freeing to realize, oh God, okay, I get it. I get what I'm doing. And just sit. And a little bit of space allows for it to move on. It's like Lama Tsultur Malioni was at a retreat we did a few months ago and talked, and she's famous for this one book, Feeding the Demons.
Yeah.
So you're not pushing this shit away that you suddenly realize just how much your reification is taking place
right.
and creating these boulders inside yourself. You get with it a little bit, you know?
Well, I mean, boulder, I think that's, I'm sorry to cut you off.
You can have a cup of tea, that's all. And that's, you know, that's something we don't do. We don't, we push this stuff away. And that
right.
is, it's as easy as we can create the thing, we can easily create enough space around that thing not to judge ourselves about it, et cetera, et cetera.
Yes, theoretically. I mean, I don't know if I agree 100% with that because it kind of reminds me of stretching. You know, like, it's not easy. I've started stretching. And it's not easy to stretch, especially at first. Like, I couldn't touch my toes. And then it hurts a little bit, like, but it's a kind of a good hurt, but it still hurts. And you sort of do it consistently. And then you get that thrilling moment of like, holy shit, I'm touching my toes. Oh my God, my head is about to touch my knees. I thought I'd never do that in my whole life. And then it gets easier. But it feels like with this, it's like that. Like, this reification is like when your body gets all cramped up. You know, you've been sitting at the computer for your whole life or most of your life or having bad posture and it's crunched you up. And in the same way, this sort of spontaneous reification of the world is a not great place is like that. It's like you haven't been stretching and it feels like it does. I think it does. It's not easy. Like, you kind of have to stretch it out a little bit over time. Slightly stretch out that your particular ice cube tray or try to add another shape in there to see what happens. But I mean, I go back to it, really. It's easy to go back to the old pattern for
me. Yeah, no, absolutely. But I do suggest that, I guess I've had the moment that I have the realization of whatever that reification, whatever that making something so solid and that's who I am. And once I realize that, there's a sense of freedom. Wow, I can see the light at the end of the tunnel.
Yes.
That's what I mean. So there is ease that happens after you become a little bit more aware of these dark places, basically.
Yes, yes.
Thank you.
So there is ease that happens after you become a little bit more aware of these dark places, basically.
Yes. And yes. Totally. That's what I love about this stuff, is that that is easy. Like, if you just spend a little bit of time fantasizing that, you don't always have to see the worst in the world or in people or in your day or what's coming, that you can make believe, if you want to, that maybe this is going to be an incredible day for you, actually, that it's going to be a wonderful day. Because, you know, and I'm speaking as someone who has gone like a year straight of just like, this sucks. Like, whatever is happening is fucked and I hate it. And
what?
Are you kidding? Come on, Raghu.
Come on, this beautiful baby just got born.
I'm not talking about now. I'm talking about years and years ago when I was trying to be fashionably cynical. And
I see. Yes. Yes.
You know, I wanted to be this sort of sophisticated darkling. You know what I mean? Like, come to.
You did a good job.
I was really good at it. I was really good at it. And it's fun at first, but then it grabs you. And the things that you have been sort of pretending to believe, you start believing, and then it can get really scary. But what you're talking about is that moment where you realize, oh, wait, I don't have to keep doing this. Even if you keep doing it, the whole game gets fucked up. The moment you realize you can stop if you want. That's where the cracks start forming in the windshield of the shit car you've been driving around hell.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Yeah.
That's exciting.
Yeah, I hate to, I mean, it's totally a reality. It's a reality why we, and certainly I, wanted to do this book. Because I thought, okay, if we use ourselves as examples here, we could maybe project the possibility of realizing that the awareness and mindfulness really do help change your day-to-day atmosphere around, you know, defending yourself, anxiety, and treating people in a way that you really don't want to, but it's inbred, you know, it's habitual patterns that happen. So at the same time, it's all okay. I mean, that's what Jack Kornfield, he has my favorite mantra.
What?
He talks about, isn't it curious to be human? Look at this thing. You have look at this. There's a space in the middle of your face that just chomps down on all kinds of different organisms. It's incredible. Have you ever watched yourself having sex? That's really out there, right? And then he goes, but through all of it, just remember, it's okay. We're human.
Right.
It's okay.
Yeah.
You know, and we wake up when we're supposed to wake up. But part of it is, now that we're looking, and the thing that just caught me with what you just suggested, now that we're looking at this extraordinary polarization in our world, manifesting in just horrific different ways, there is and I go back to the thing about the yugas or Bruce Damer's, hey, we are an interactive species. Yeah. That is what we're talking about. This reification, this making, in this case, hatred and division so strongly embedded all through the world. And now tough thing for us to live with on a day-to-day basis with this kind of suffering. So then maybe that's a motivator too. So I'm not just saying the motivator is just, okay, a great one is I don't want to be unhappy anymore, period. Yeah. I don't want to be in anxiety anymore. So you start to do the kinds of things that help transform that. But now, and you see this world, and you understand, if you've taken any psychedelic, most especially, you have that insight that interconnectivity is real. Absolutely. That ineffable experience is the most, gives us a big advantage to know that it's real.
I think that one way people misunderstand what you're talking about is they think that you're inviting them to be this sort of like
monkey
idiot,
monk, not monkey,
idiot, monk. Like just some kind of idiot, like some kind of idiot who is not seeing that there's also an aspect of reality where there is justice, where there is right and wrong, and where in sort of letting go of all the habitual ways that you separate yourself from others based on ethics or whatever, that you just are going to become a drooling, loving idiot, like a big, fat, drooling dummy that just is like sitting.
It's a cartoon. This would be a good cartoon for you to narrate.
Everything. Jeffrey Dahmer. I love him so much. I'm one with Jeffrey Dahmer. He's me and I am him. Like that. And that's not what we're talking about.
I hope not.
But, you know, in my own sort of, you know, everyone who's like, whatever it is you're looking at in the world, the go-to is, okay, who is right here and who is wrong here? And if you can determine that in your own mind and really commit to it, then what that means is that you only have to feel half the heartbreak, because you'll feel heartbreak for the people who you think are right and everything that has been happening to them, but you won't feel it for the people you think are wrong quite as much, because you'll say, well, they kind of deserve that. And this is the case for everything. And people don't realize that when they're doing that, really there's, at least for me, I realize, oh, I'm doing that because I don't want to feel the whole heartbreak. I only want to feel part of the heartbreak and not the whole awful, almost unbearable reality of what's happening, taking away the right and the wrong, and just, and then suddenly you really experience the world instead of hiding behind whatever team you're on. That is not easy to do. It is so much easier, but I think you can do that and then still take sides. You know what I mean? You can open your heart up to all of the suffering in a legitimate way, and then whatever team that you're on, that feeling is going to motivate the way you encourage other people on your team to behave. You know, that's how it's like peace could come, maybe.
Yeah, well, it's like going to, we're going to protest against whatever, and we're going to go down there, and we're going to have a peace march, whatever we're going to do. And we go down there, and, you know, Ram Dass used to tell this story. I go down there because he went to one, and, you know, people were shouting epithets at everyone on the other side and throwing shit. And it was just peace,
or I'll fucking kill you. If you're not for peace, I'll kill your ass. Yeah, that's the big, that's the paradox.
Yeah, exactly. So, and on a much more subtle level, just going there and having anger towards the other side will do exactly the opposite of whatever you think you're trying to do to correct an injustice.
Yeah.
And that is very difficult. And it all goes back to, you've got, until you get your own self straightened out where you're not so polarized. I mean, we're going to be polarized and it's going to go on, but there is a way to get less polarized, to a way to deal with dark shit and not run away from it, and be able to have a relationship with that which is uncomfortable.
Yes.
And that's one of the main things, especially in the West, Duncan. I mean, you've been in India, but I mean, these people, they know how to take discomfort. I mean, I just all around me all the time is an example of that. Whenever I go there and hang out with family and so on, the Indian family. And this is something that's impossible for us here. Anyhow, but it's not even, you know, that's extraordinarily important, being able to handle the 100,000 horrible visions and the 100,000 beautiful visions, which is the ancient, as the ancient texts say. So I, but I think the solidity that's happening in groups around this world, in nations, in it's just so absolutely reified. It is so strong, and it's enough of a another motivation to do something for yourself that allows you to make some contribution that is not biased, so heavily biased, along the side of your own proclivities in terms of being comfortable. That's what I mean about discomfort,
It's so comforting to like really fully join a team. And you can still be on your fucking team. Like that's the thing, is it's not an invitation to then throw your flag down or anything like that. It's just like I read something, I don't know if this is true or not, something about how the samurai, when they were dueling, like they would love they the part of the training was to learn how to love the person you were gonna kill, like really love them. So when they were killing, they were do you, you know they were killing with love. They love they were killing someone they loved, meaning if they were doing it, there was no other choice. You know, imagine killing someone you love. That was in their training.
It's the Gita, right? It's the whole Bhagavad
Exactly. And that there is a way. And thank God most of us, and hopefully most of us, don't have to do have to kill. But it reminds me of something. I think it was that awesome documentary you showed at the last retreat I was at, about the way.
Brilliant
Yes,
disguise.
and Krishna Das
The
arguing
samadhi
with
of K.C. Tiwari.
to argue how the way they would argue, they would have these ferocious arguments, spiritual arguments, and yet they loved each other. And so, but that didn't mean that the arguments look like, when you say that, it makes me feel like this. It's full on screaming arguments. But because there's love behind it, it becomes lighter, more like a game. Because they know at the other end of the screaming, the love is just is going to be there.
Exactly. Yeah, that's a great example of what we're talking about. The possibility of really transforming out of this polarization. And what does it? Love. Absolutely 100%. You know, I wanted to bring something else that I came across the other day. Another person I did a podcast with, Orin J. Sofer, actually. And it's a subject, it's a talking point that is so hard for us in the West to have any relationship with. But to me, it's the one of the most misunderstood concepts, and it is yet so dearly important, actually. And what I came across, he just put it in ways that are a little bit more understandable and not so quote unquote religious. And it's what Ram Dass, when he first came back from India, he said, there's a few things I can't talk about in the West. And he named them. Guru was one, because that's really tears people up. Somebody's going to take over my life. Fuck
Hell
that.
no.
The other one, the second to that, was surrender. Surrender. What? Give all my money and shit to somebody? You know, completely concept gone. And the third one was devotion, which immediately sets up a thing of fear. Devotion. Wow. Here's what he said. Devotion is some of this is just a great viewpoint that just turns you around. It's the this particular teacher is a Buddhist. It's the willingness to give our heart to something completely. Willingness to give our heart. I mean, you do that when you fall in love, right? It is a way of relating to anything in life with deep love, loyalty, and generosity of spirit. In wholeheartedly engaging with life, devotion helps us realize our aspirations and bring satisfaction and fulfillment. Devotion heals us, feeds our heart, and sustains us with well-being during our challenges. Devotion provides a foundation for long-term engagement and plays a crucial role in transforming our inner and outer worlds. I thought, this is a great definition of it, rather than the quote unquote more traditional bhakti definition of it. The way, you know, just the thinking of devoting oneself to say, I do not want to be unhappy anymore.
Right.
I do not want to have anxiety anymore. I want to wholeheartedly engage with these things that are causing my life to be a shitstorm a lot of the time. That devotion to wanting to transform, or I see these things going on in our world and I want to devote myself to helping to make change, or whatever it may be, that wholehearted willingness, as he says, to devote oneself with purpose, with meaning, with transforming that bugaboo, me guy, I think it's a great methodology for being able to make that move.
And it's,
I really do.
But what I love about bhakti yoga, or my encounter with the Hare Krishnas and all the various literature they put out, is, you know, bhakti, it's done an incredible job of sort of quantifying or mapping out this path. And so within it, it talks about, with devotion, the sort of phases of it. And the first phase of it is you do kind of have to push yourself a little bit. You can't feel completely secure in the idea of altering your life in a way that you begin to really devote yourself to shifting some of these patterns or karmic loops that you're stuck in. But you like the idea. It sounds good. And so you sort of start working with it a little bit. But in bhakti yoga, it talks about, but then something wonderful starts happening, which is an attraction develops to the whatever your practice is. That it's not a one-way street. Yeah. That the moment there's some expression of real, sincere devotion, it's like the universe starts pulling you in deeper. And then it goes from having to discipline yourself to do whatever your particular practice is, meditation, whatever it may be. Now you start wanting to do it, longing for it, pining. That's the word the Hare Krishnas love to use. And of course, they're talking about you're pining after Krishna. And they will say, it goes from you'll read the Bhagavad Gita and think that's cool to one day suddenly you're like, God, I really just want to read the Bhagavad Gita. And then you're reading it, and then suddenly you have to read it every day. Or you start longing to look at a picture of Krishna. You know what I mean? You want to see just a picture, or a picture of Prabhupada, or your guru, or whatever. And then this thing starts happening. Something starts pulling you in. And that, to me, is really scary. You know what I mean?
Well,
that aspect of it is scary. Because it can get really powerful.
Yeah. Yeah, well, when you ask, you receive. You really do, especially if it's in any kind of sincere ask to the universe, whatever you want to call that thing that holds, is the glue.
The glue man.
You know,
pray to the glue man, and he will stick you to himself.
Yeah, Bruce and I were talking, Damon and I were talking about, so he called the glue an operating system.
Okay.
And then I thought, that's exactly what my experience with Neem Karoli Baba was.
Right.
That there wasn't a me and you kind of thing that just wasn't happening. It's hard to explain what that was, but it wasn't happening. It was just this thing with a blanket around it, this human being with a blanket around him, was just, you could see that there was nothing in this human being that was saying, I'm going to do this or that, or thought of anything. It was an operating system that did the right thing.
Yeah.
Much better than, you know, my computer sometimes, which doesn't do the right thing. But this thing did the right thing for that human being, for them to become who they true naturally are.
Right.
In their true nature, who they are. And, you know, that's, of course, we spend a lifetime going through lifting all of the onion skin off of that one. And you know, it's something that is the reality is that because we were so attracted to this unconditionality, you know, through this being, that it gave us gigantic, the thing you just mentioned, a gigantic motivation. And we were like being pulled through a something.
Yeah.
You know, like a birth cord, basically.
And, yeah, that's wild.
You know,
an operating system. I mean, but then this is the, to get back to the we, me to we, this is that thing that happens when you are around a group of people who are intentionally chanting or whatever. That somehow, maybe you are a million miles away from being able to let go of yourself and become that channel or portal to the glue man, to the operating system. Why can't we just say God anymore? I say God.
God, no, we can't.
You can't say God anymore. Not allowed to anymore. You have to say source. No. You have to say the glue man. It's God. And so when you get
glue, can't be. It's a glue, not man.
Let's okay, it's a glue being.
Because it's not.
Yeah. I worship the glue being, but the when you know when those retreats, there have been times doing kirtan where you're just not there anymore. You're just part, and it's not like you. Therefore, you don't exist. It's not nihilism, but it's like you merge into this sweet group consciousness that represents all the people chanting, and you could just feel the love. So, and the love is so real that it stops being I'm feeling it, and you become it. And I think something about sharing a space with that intention allows people to connect with the glue being.
The glue. Yeah, the glue being, yeah. And, you know, by the way, in my experience, and I meet tons of people all the time in the work that I do, everybody has had some ineffable experience in their life, which is the same as you just described. Suddenly, you're not thinking about yourself. You're part of a one heart thing.
Yeah.
I mean, it all sounds new agey, but it's real. That does happen. It happens. Go to a concert. You know, I'm sure it's happening at, you know, Taylor Swift, right? They're just feeling this complete at oneness in that moment.
Maybe, I don't know.
That is, I don't know. I haven't been there either.
I don't know, man. Okay? I don't know. Maybe.
Yeah, maybe.
Maybe.
They seem to be.
Fine. I guess so.
Oh, Christ. All right. Well, my own experience. Okay.
Fine.
I was with John Coltrane one day, and you know this story a billion times over. And I went into that ineffable space. I'm just saying, through a piece of music, through a friend, through a book, through a film, through an anything, through a psychedelic, of course. That ineffable experience, you know, we're going to be doing all kinds of investigations, love serve through Ram Dass's representation around science, spirituality, and psychedelic insight. And that ineffable thing happens, that insight happens. And that leads one to understand, wow, there's a greater purpose here for me other than completely feeling like I'm fending for myself as a separate unit. And there, so I believe it's real. I know it's real.
Check out our book. Check out our audiobook, friends. We did it. For years we've been working on this thing. Raghu handled the brunt of it, organized it, produced it, and now it exists on Audible. It's waiting for you. Raghu, tell them about how they can download the book.
Movieofme.com. That's the website, and the links are there for Amazon, Audible, and iTunes, where you can get the audiobook and download it. And it's 10 and a half hours, so it'll keep you busy for a while. And everybody, write a review. Like we say in the thing, the Krishnadas' whole thing, which is where this comes from, the movie of me, you wake up in the morning, you're the chief protagonist, you're the writer, you're the director, you're the producer, and you even write your own reviews. But in this case, we do want you to write a review and put it up on iTunes or Audible or whatever, Amazon. and enjoy. Yeah, movieofme.com. From there, you'll be able to get directed to whatever your favorite Audible or iTunes basically is. So, yeah. And there's a sample there and yeah, all kinds of other
Well, you are the
goodies.
bragu. I can't believe that we finally finished this thing. I'm so lucky to have you as
I
my friend. You are
know.
so brilliant. And yeah, I don't know if I'd be as connected to the glue man or the glue being if not for you. The glue being is the worst descriptor for God I've ever heard of in my life.
If you've ever heard. I know. I just that it just came to me in a moment of
The glue
complete
being,
ridiculous fantasy.
where three
Yeah, the
or more
glue
of you
being
are gathered, the glue being will come. Is there?
is there. Yeah, there. That's our new. Let's put that as a meme up on social and so on. Oh, I have to give credit. Wait a minute. You can't credit me with. Yes, I
Yes.
was involved heavily in the production of this thing. We both were, but Katrina Fernandez is the
Right.
producer of this book, and we had some also very early help, and very, very helpful was with Ganesh
Yeah, that's right.
Braemar. Okay, I want to give credit to those
Absolutely.
two guys for sure, and of course, Krishan Das gets 99% of the credit because we bagged his shit and
Well,
took
he
it
let
on,
us. You asked him, right?
and he, yeah. No, not yet. I will though. Oh, God.
Okay, Raghu. Well, thank you so much for coming back on the show. Everybody, download
Thank
our
you.
Audible, please. We love you. I love you, Raghu. Thank you so much. Have a
Thank
wonderful
you.
day. Ram Ram.
See you later.
That was Raghu Marcus, everybody. The links you need to find our audiobook will be at DuncanTrussell.com. It's from the movie of me to the movie of we. Thank you to our wonderful sponsors. Go see me live. I hope to see you out there. Spokane, I just want to say I love you guys. These have been delightful shows. I love all of you. Thank you for letting me have this as my job. I'll see you next week. Until then, Hare Krishna.